And our last speaker is Eric Singer, who has expertise in ethics and is a urologist from the Rutgers Cancer Institute of New Jersey.
Thank you very much. Great opportunity to be here. I apologize with the speed with which we'll go through things, but there are some fabulous cases that I'm sure you all want to see. Some research funding from Astellas Medivation, more importantly, Red Sox fan, so last night was a great event, so they won. All right. We'll talk briefly, tip of the hat to all the presenters so far. They've included some great ethical and palliative care issues in all their talks so far. Just want to hit a little bit on consent and capacity, futility, opportunities for consultation with other providers, and perioperative advance directives. So you're all very familiar with informed consent. I think one of the things that I wanted to touch on here is the idea of adequate disclosure being important. And for us, talking about this patient population, I think diagnosis and prognosis, alternatives, consequences are all going to be very much at the forefront. I think in addition to consequences in terms of longevity, but also if you go ahead and do something heroic or invasive, how is it going to change quality of life? So often I'm speaking with my patients, you know, this may be the operation that means that you're not able to go back home and live independently. Do you want to think about going forward with that? Obviously, patients who have diminished decision-making capacity, there are some special considerations. Of course, capacity is not static. It is a snapshot. It changes over time. We presume adult patients to have decision-making capacity. Of course, the capacity assessment, which really can be done by any of us. We do it every time we obtain consent from someone for a surgery or a procedure. We don't have to depend on our colleagues from psychiatry or something else like that, but really trying to answer the question, who is the best person to make decisions for this patient? Of course, we have this balance, this tension between autonomy, the right to self-determination, and of course, our obligation to non-maleficence, protecting patients, avoiding harm. And we have the Siegler rule. Mark Siegler, a bioethicist at University of Chicago, reminds us that freedom permits tragedy. From time to time, despite our best efforts, patients may end up making decisions that are perhaps against what we think might be best. I'll pivot quickly to futility, my second favorite F word. The concept of futility is, of course, familiar to all of us. It may come up in some of these discussions of the cases, but it's very difficult, I think, to precisely define, let alone use consistently in practice. I think there are two main reasons why the concept of futility has existed throughout recorded medical history. Number one, prevent unnecessary patient suffering from inappropriate interventions or treatments, and then also to sort of protect the integrity of medicine, or in this case, surgery. I think it's important to keep in mind what futility is not. So it's not just the implausible or the unlikely. It is not hopelessness. So certainly I've had many patients who've remained incredibly hopeful despite some really dire conditions or situations. And it's not rationing. All right, so rationing is looking at resources and how we treat a group of people where we're considering futility. We're actually looking at an individual patient, individual physician-patient relationship. If we look at sort of a principle-based approach to futility, again, everything sort of comes back to autonomy, the patient or patient surrogate's ability to accept or decline what you're offering. However, it's important to note that autonomy doesn't mean that they get to request or demand therapy that you don't think is appropriate or indicated. So autonomy is not a trump to physician conscience or moral agency. Just reminding us of sort of some of our historical pieces here. Oftentimes we think that the idea of do no harm comes in the Hippocratic Oath. In fact, it's not. It's in epidemics, but the idea in the oath requires us to actually do an even higher obligation to do what we think is best, do what we think is right for the patient. So an idea, an appeal to beneficence. When I think about futility, I think really more of it is a prudential guide. This is a concept developed by Ed Pellegrino, who was really more of a virtue ethicist than a principalist. But I think it's very helpful to think about it in that he declared or wrote that really when we're thinking about futility, we're thinking about effectiveness, benefit, and burden. So those three things coming into play when we're making a consideration. And really, the effectiveness is really best assessed by the physician. That's the realm of our evidence-based medicine, our empirical studies, and really the surgeons or other healthcare providers are best able to say whether they think this is likely to work and how likely that would be. Benefit, though, is really, I think, best in the domain of the patient or the patient's surrogate. Refers to patient values. And again, remembering hierarchy of goods, as was mentioned in the very first speaker. So is it to exist, to stay alive as absolutely long as possible? Is it to stay alive to see the birth of a grandchild or meet some other important obligation? Or is it really to focus on quality of life over quantity? And that certainly is best described and answered by the patient. In terms of burdens, so whether there be physical, psychological, financial toxicity, those are certainly both going to be the realm of the physician and the patient. We can certainly say what we expect is likely to happen if you do this therapy or not, and then the patient is able to say, yes, that's something I can live with, or no, that's really a bridge too far, that's not something I want to participate in. And so again, just going back, as I think one of the downsides of a lot of these surgical oncology emergencies is that they are patients who are very sick. However, perhaps on the upside is that they're patients that we may have a very established relationship with and allows us to have a better understanding and conversation about some of these difficult but very important aspects. So there's no easy way I can tell you this, so I'm sending you to someone I can, someone who can. So that's certainly not the way we practice, but it is occasionally important to think about when we want to bring in other folks to help us address potential futility conflicts, whether it's a matter of conscience and a colleague may be better able to deal with that, sending to another facility that may have different resources, bringing in social work, pastoral care, ethics, palliative care. In terms of perioperative advance directives, many patients complete advance directives, living will, MOLST or PULSE, the medical orders for life-sustaining therapy, or physician or provider orders for life-sustaining therapy, depending on what state you're in, or healthcare proxy. I think that really the one that I recommend patients to complete most is designating a healthcare proxy. I think it's certainly challenging to anticipate in a living will all these things that may happen in the future. And again, this resides as an expression of patient autonomy. And recognizing that unfortunately there are situations where our ability to intervene is very limited. One of the challenges with perioperative advance directives is it can sometimes be difficult to really differentiate resuscitation versus maintaining homeostasis. I mean, we have someone in the ICU, it's really difficult to say where does resuscitation end and just sort of maintaining them begins. And certainly some patients with terminal conditions or severe comorbidities and advanced directives may benefit from invasive procedures. Well, yes, it's a routine procedure if you routinely have someone slice open your body with sharp instruments and fiddle with your insides. So, yeah, routine sort of varies by your job. But what should we do with their advanced directive? So options for a patient who has an advanced directive but may benefit from an invasive procedure, we could automatically revoke it, say, look, if you're going to go past this line in the OR, you need to be full code, full intervention. We could refuse to treat and say, no, I'm not going to do this. You can either go someplace else or not have therapy or perhaps a better way. And that comes in with the required reconsideration. And we have a statement by the American College of Surgeons, American Society of Anesthesiology, and the Association of OR Nurses, who all say automatic revocation or suspension is not appropriate. So if those three groups all agree on something, that's probably worth considering. In terms of required reconsideration, the patient may decide, yes, I'm willing to suspend my DNR and go full resuscitation. The patient and physician will then need to decide when are they going to reinstate that advance directive. They may say that suspending it is not congruent, and they may decide to just accept palliation or go someplace else or do something different. A medical management, and again, anesthesiologists and surgeons and nurses may not be forced to participate, again, as a matter of conscience. And then, of course, we can do reach some kind of compromise with the idea of limited resuscitation. So these limited resuscitations can be either procedurally or goal-directed. Procedurally directed limited resuscitation can sort of put together a list of items that the patient or surrogate would be willing to accept. The benefit of this kind of list of interventions is that it's easy to transition between care teams, such as an ICU with revolving attending staff, where the goal-directed is really, I think, a better option, but again, requires an attending surgeon with an established relationship who is able to decide in the moment, if there is a crisis, what the patient would be willing to accept to help achieve his or her goals. This is a case that I don't think we need to go through because we've got some great ones coming up. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I really appreciate your time.